Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what it feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boosts and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Epochs!
Hello and welcome back to Epochs. If you remember last time, I'd finally finished the story all about Magellan. Now, I thought I'd do a one-off palate cleanser before I change entirely to a completely different epoch in history. But I thought where I'd spoken quite a lot about the Spanish and the Portuguese sailors and explorers and adventurers, I thought, well, it's only really right that I speak about an English one. So today I'm going to try and make it a one-off episode. So it will be a bit of an overview, but a one-off episode all about Sir Walter Raleigh. So, you know, just to give the English perspective on these things a little bit. So, okay, let's talk about that. I couldn't just leave you with letting people think that the Spanish and Portuguese were the only ones that did daring adventures on the high seas in the late Middle Ages in the 16th century. There was Frenchmen and Englishmen and Dutchmen that did all that sort of thing. But obviously, being an Englishman, I want to keep up the end and talk a bit about Sir Walter Raleigh. So one of the first things to say is it's a bit later than Magellan. Okay, so Magellan's, if you remember, the Magellan voyage was in the 1520s. And the events of Sir Walter Raleigh's life is much later in the 16th century, like in the 1570s, 80s, 90s, and even into the very beginning of the 17th century, the 1600s. So it's a bit later. So before I actually dive in and talk all about just the life and career of Raleigh himself, I need to give you just a little bit of an overview of what happened since the age of Magellan. And as I say, I'm going to try and pack all this into one episode. So today it will be, you know, something of an overview rather than a sort of super deep dive as the Magellan thing had done. I can't do that every time. In fact, it probably wouldn't be advisable. So for this one, a lot had happened in the next sort of 50 years after Magellan. Portugal and Spain had both gone on, as well as the little bit of the Dutch and a little bit of the French and a little bit of the English, but mainly the Portuguese and the Spanish, or Castilians, had gone on to sort of consolidate their hold on all sorts of places around the world, but particularly the Spanish. So by the time of Drake, that's Sir Francis Drake, which is his life overlaps Sir Walter Raleigh, but he's a little bit older. By the time of Drake and Sir Walter Raleigh, Spain had really become, and some argue about exactly to what extent this is true, but had really become the most powerful country in the world. You know, there's some caveats to that. Some would say France still was sort of the strongest land power in Europe. But in terms of commerce, in terms of sort of global reach, in a few different ways, in terms of navy, it's kind of the Spanish, sort of the United States of the mid and late 16th century. They're the most powerful country in the world, and certainly on the rise as well, it seems like. It looks like they're only going to get more powerful, if anything. So that Magellan thing, well, first of all, Christopher Columbus and the Magellan thing, really does set Spain up to sort of start eclipsing Portugal and everyone else. They're getting lots and lots of treasure, largely silver, more silver than gold, but also gold, but all sorts of treasure and other commodities from the New World, from the Americas, both sort of what is modern day Florida and in the Caribbean, which today is the Caribbean. Mesoamerica, you know, the central bit of America, all of, you know, places like Mexico and Honduras and all that sort of thing, and South America, places, Brazil, what is modern day Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela, all that sort of thing. So, and they've had basically a monopoly on it. If you remember, I talked about that treaty that the Pope had struck. This is even before Magellan, between the Spanish and the Portuguese, dividing the world up between them. And so, well, the Spanish had just made great gains on all of that. They were becoming, or had already become, extremely rich and powerful. Incidentally, slight side note for any Fedora tippers out there, the internal economy of Spain wasn't that good. And a lot of this gold and silver actually ended up as tribute, finding its way to Rome and the popes. But still, at a certain point in time, particularly in the 16th and 17th century, so much silver and gold was flowing back to Spain from the New World, various places in the New World, that Spain could afford, among other things, a big navy. And so, you know, keep consolidating their position, again, all around the world. That's one of the things, isn't it? It's a classic thing. Money breeds money. The more money you've got, the more you can spend on accruing new money, more money. It's often the way it is, you know. It's terrible when it's the other way around, isn't it? You haven't got any money and you're broke, but you need a bit of money to get off the ground and you haven't got any, so you're stuck. Well, the other way is true. You just keep investing your fortunes in new ventures to make more. It's not fair, is it? But that's the way the world goes around. Okay, anyway. So Spain, everyone was jealous of Spain, right? Everyone else, not everyone, but, you know, in Europe, in Western Europe, anyway. Everyone else sees Spain and thinks, well, that's not fair. We want a slice of that action, right? It's not fair. As simple as that. That's not fair. And, I mean, England is one of those. We're not Britain yet. It is still England. England sees this. France, the Low Countries, Holland, basically. Various countries, some of the Italian republics, they all see this and they're like, we want a bit of that action. But according to the Pope, anyway, you're not allowed to. According to Rome and the Pope, the Atlantic and certainly all the New World, or the West Coast or the East Coast of the New World is it's all Spanish. So countries like France or England, not allowed, as far as the Pope is concerned, to just go across and start taking land and making colonies and exploring and all that sort of thing. Well, there's some countries, Protestant countries, that don't give a fig what the Pope says in Rome, don't give a fig about what the King of Castile or Spain wants or says. We're just going to do it. So, cut back to England. We had Henry VIII, right, through the 16th century, the middle part and some of the latter parts of the 16th century. And anyone who knows anything about Henry VIII, and I will get to him in crazy detail at some point in epochs, he famously broke with Rome. And although during his lifetime, his exact relationship with Rome and with Protestantism and his interest in Lutheranism and all that sort of thing was actually quite ambiguous. It wasn't completely clear. It wasn't like Henry VIII on one particular day decided he's not going to be Catholic anymore. He's just a Protestant, quote-unquote Protestant now, and that's it going forward. It wasn't like that. Henry VIII kept the whole thing deliberately muddy and unclear. He'd certainly sort of broken with Rome to a degree, but he sort of vacillated over years of this. He sort of vacillated back and forth, saying he's some sort of repentant Catholic and he really is a Catholic in all but name. And then other days, you know, weeks later or months later, he will say super hardline Protestant things and rail against the Pope and Rome. He kept doing that for years. Okay, so it wasn't clear. Okay, so then after him, his son Edward, who didn't reign for all that long and was quite young and died young, he was super hardline Protestant, just absolutely straight up and down hardline Protestant, because the people that had surrounded him, the people that had raised him, and then the people that surrounded him once he was king, they were all hardline Protestants, and particularly like the Archbishop of Canterbury and things. And it was in their interest to make sure that England became fully, you know, fully Protestant and stayed that way. So at that point, England's now Protestant. And then when Edward dies of natural causes, his older sister, Mary, takes over, Bloody Mary, and she's married to the King of Spain. And she's hardcore Catholic. So she takes the country back to full-blown, at least on paper, full-blown Catholicism. Okay. Then she doesn't rule for all that long. She then dies of natural causes. And then her little sister takes over, Elizabeth, Good Queen Bess. And we get the Elizabethan age. Elizabeth became queen when she was quite young. What was she? 17? 16, 17 or 18? She was young. She was a girl, really, when she became queen. And she didn't die until she was like 70, 69 or 70. So she's queen for, you know, 50 years plus. So we've got a whole age there, the Elizabethan age. Lots of historians like to think of it as, or say it is, a golden age that we sort of, in some senses, come out of the darkness of the medieval period and come into sort of what might be, we might think of as like the English Renaissance or something, or the early modern period or something like that. It is very, very easy, even though this isn't good history, really. I mean, serious good academic history. It isn't good to say this, but it does feel like a golden age. And there's no such thing really as a golden age. It's just a term people say. For a lot of people, it would have been just as bloody and short and nasty as ages before and after it. But nonetheless, you look back on the Elizabethan age, Shakespeare and all sorts of things, and it seems like a golden age. Okay, so this is the time in which Sir Walter Raleigh lived and Drake. And Elizabeth is a Protestant, okay? And then so after Elizabeth, we'd never go back to Catholicism with one, perhaps you might argue, one tiny blip, James II, but that's a different story. Basically, the low resolution overview is that once Elizabeth becomes queen after Mary, Bloody Mary, England becomes Protestant and is Protestant forevermore until this day. Okay, so you can see that from the age of Henry VIII through to Elizabeth, England has kind of vacillated, well, definitely has vacillated between being Catholic and Protestant. And all through this time and after, there are big wars of religion in Europe. Protestants and Catholics all over Europe, having wars, butchering each other, all sorts of frightfulness. And we managed, the English, managed to stay out of that, largely. Good Queen Bess, old Lizzie, Thin Lizzie, manages to keep us out of this. Her position on it all is that you can't really be a Catholic priest. Like, if we catch you being a Catholic priest, you're in trouble. You might well get, you certainly get arrested, and you may well be executed. So you can't be preaching Catholicism. But if you're a Catholic inside your own heart and mind, that's okay. Like, she's not going to send out witch finder generals to interrogate people to find out if they're secretly Catholic and then burn you at the stake. It's not that. Okay, so again, historians argue over exactly to what degree there was a police state in the Elizabethan age about Catholicism and things. But if there were sort of, you know, Spanish, i.e. Catholic, spies and agent provocateurs in England, that would be a problem. They would be arrested and executed and all that sort of thing. And sometimes the authorities would even turn a blind eye. If you was extremely rich and powerful, like a duke or something, and you had, in your own castle, you had a chapel, which a lot of them did, most of them did, and you wanted to completely privately still have what is, to all intents and purposes, a Catholic mass, and you just kept it quiet, you kept it on the down low, and you didn't sort of make a big song and dance out of it. You just did it privately, and you kept it inside your own heart and mind. That would be okay, usually. Okay, so in other words, compared to the continent, what was going on the continent, that's quite relaxed. Elizabeth would say things like, you know, it's not the place of the prince, i.e. her, a king, it's not the place of a prince to sort of legislate what's in someone's heart or mind. Anyway, despite all of that, what we're saying, all of that, and some historians would argue with what I just said there, say, no, it's much more repressive than that. Anyway, okay, haven't got time to go into all that in massive detail, maybe another time. Formally, legally, Britain is the Anglican Church, the Church of England, Protestantism. That is the formal religion. Okay, so now, on the sort of the grand scene, as I said, Spain is the main superpower, perhaps you might say the only hyperpower at this point. And England is a mixture of jealous and scared, right? For quite a while, there's been this sort of this three-way power struggle between England, France, and Spain, certainly in terms of power, the power dynamic in Europe, this is, not necessarily on the high seas and in the New World or anything. But so there's this three-way, for a few generations, a three-way thing between England, France, and Spain, and you sort of each of those three parties sort of trying to balance their power against each other and kind of constantly making alliances and breaking alliances and realizing when one of them becomes too overly powerful, you'll sort of gang up against them and so on and so on and so on endlessly. Well, at this particular stage, it's sort of Spain has got the upper hand. So France is obviously wary and England is wary, and I mean, England, some historians like to say, especially in recent years, it's a revisionist, it's a modish thing for court historians, sort of boomer historians who hate themselves and hate England, say that England was just a backwater, just a nothing sort of country in, you know, the age of Elizabeth and Henry VIII and things. And that, it, you know, it wasn't until the age of true empire that Britain became a big player. And before that, we were backward. France and Spain were the big players and England was sort of nothing. Well, that's just not true. I mean, if you go back to, you can go back to sort of the age of Henry II or something. We can go back a long way. England's always been one of the big players, among the big players in Europe, and certainly Northwest Europe, for a long, long time. So at this point in the 16th century, you know, we're up there. Spain is definitely the top dog. I'm not saying they're not. Spain's definitely sort of got the upper hand at this point. But England's sort of in the running. They're not, you know, it's not a tiny little, basically a tiny little country like Denmark, say. Not that Denmark's that tiny, but, you know, England has got pretensions to be and could potentially be one of the big players. And so they see that, everyone sees, it's obvious, it's no secret, that the thing that is sort of feeding Spain is the New World. You know, Columbus has sailed the ocean blue in 1492. Let's say 1492. So already by the age of Elizabeth, Elizabeth comes to the throne in 1558. Already by that point, it's been, well, 60, knocking 70 years since Columbus. So everyone knows of the New World, right? They know that there's all these islands in the Caribbean. And then they know that there's these two massive continent-sized land masses, one to the north and one to the south of that. And that they represent, and what they are, you know, a source of endless riches and resource and power and influence, giant, giant land masses. So the idea that Spain has just got a complete monopoly on all of that, that's sort of not going to fly. Now, a lot of countries in the world, in Europe, when the Pope says no, it's a no, right? If there's a papal bull or a papal decree or a treaty that's been ratified by Rome and the Pope that says you're just not allowed to go to the New World, that's Spain's exclusively. A lot of countries will say, oh, okay, fair enough. You know, we don't want to get excommunicated. We're not going to, you know, it is what it is. The Pope has said so. The King of Spain has said so. We can't stand up to either of those. So, okay. But other countries, if you're a Protestant country particularly, will say, no, F that. F all of that. We're going to do what we want. Who's going to stop us? What, the King of Spain? Yeah, try it then. Try it. Who's going to stop us? The Pope. Yeah, well, no, don't care. I don't care. We don't care what the Pope says. You're like a false, you're a false thing. We don't recognise popes. Well, and so that is England of the 1560s and 70s and 80s and 90s. We're in exactly that position. Right? We don't care what the Pope said. So that's just off the table. That treaty that the Spanish and the Portuguese signed, don't care about that. They're our enemies. So why would we care about that? And then being worried or scared about the King of Spain and his ships, his navy, his armada. We'll have to brave that. We'll have to run that risk because there's too much at stake. There's just too much at stake. There's two things. One, if we just allow Spain to endlessly, you know, take money and wealth and resources from the New World back to Spain, they'll completely dominate. They really will become a completely unassailable hyperpower. The fear is forever. That they'll just utterly, utterly dominate. So one, if we can disrupt that in any way, and then secondly, if we can actually take things for ourselves. So there's a double whammy, a double thing going on there. Simply just disrupt Spain and start taking stuff for ourselves. So that's what Elizabeth decides to do. I mean, things like that had already started even before Elizabeth became queen. Now, Elizabeth herself wasn't massively warlike in any way. She was, again, historians will argue about this a bit, but she was actually quite vacillating. She was, okay, it's funny, at different times in her life and at different, when you catch her in a different mood, sometimes she's quite bellicose and aggressive, but often she's not. I mean, there's that classic thing when the Armada itself comes up, which we'll get to in a moment. You know, she's supposed to have said, or at least Shakespeare says that she says, you know, she has the stomach and heart of a king of England. And she's an extremely strong woman, and you don't mess with her. Okay, so at some points that. And at other times, she's like, She's very timid in terms of policy and going to war. Very, very timid. Everyone around her and her Privy Council and things are saying, look, we've got to go to war here or there. We've got to respond in a military fashion here or there. And she'll be like, no, 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 let's not do that. No, 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 that's too dangerous. I don't know. I'll make up my mind tomorrow. And then tomorrow comes, oh, I don't know. I'll make up my mind next week. So anyway, all that said, I suppose the takeaway is Elizabeth I, she was, it would depend what mood you would catch her in. She's very much like her father in that sense. And she would sort of sometimes maddeningly change her mind. She'd tell everyone what the policy was going to be, what she wanted, what the crown was going to do. And then like quite soon after, change her mind and reverse everything. And it would screw everything up. So she'd vacillate a bit. Okay. So, but anyway, she does decide that England, we are going to screw with Spain. And we are going to try and take bits of the new world for ourselves, or at least explore them. But she does it in a fairly tepid way, right? She's not like, okay, let's put together a giant shipbuilding program. Let's try and rival Spain in terms of shipbuilding and in terms of fighting them on the oceans and in the Caribbean and on the east coasts of North and South America. It wasn't quite like that, but she did say, where there's lots of people coming to her, lots of brave adventurers and sea captains coming to her and the people around her saying, look, just give me that chance. Give me a royal charter. Give me sort of legal, formal leave to go and fight the Spanish on the Spanish main, the Spanish coastlines of the New World in the Caribbean and stuff. You know, give me a shot, coach. Just let me on the field, coach. I can do it. And she would pretty much a lot of the time say, no, 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 no. It's far too dangerous. We don't want to antagonize Spain. You know, that's no good. We can't do that. But then sometimes she would say, yes, all right then, go on. So again, it depended what mood you caught her in. I mean, well, you say that she did rule for so long, you know, 50 plus years, but over those years, the relationship with Spain went through peaks and troughs. Sometimes it did seem in the national interest just to keep the peace and let everything simmer down. And if the Spanish are going to be kind and peaceful, then we'll reciprocate, and that's the best thing to do. That's in our interest to do. Then at other times, you know, it might be only 1 year later. It's like, no, they're painting us into a corner and we've got no option but to be aggressive back. Or Spain's at a particularly low ebb in one way or another. And, you know, it's just a window of opportunity for us, the English. If we strike here or there at just this moment, it's sort of a freebie. You know, things like that. 50 years is a long time. So, okay, at various points, Elizabeth sort of allows this stuff to happen. So a great example of it is Sir Francis Drake. And other men, like John Hawkins, eventually at a certain point, Elizabeth's like, okay, I'll formally, you know, give the sign of approval from the crown. And you guys can go to West Africa and all in the Atlantic and all in the Caribbean and the east coast of the Americas. You can go there and basically screw with the Spanish. You know, these are privateers. Some people, from the Spanish point of view, these are simply pirates with a royal sanction. They're nothing more than sort of marauders and pirates. You know, and to the English, they're just heroes, right? They're just fighting the enemy. That's what they're doing. They're doing sort of the right thing. They've got a royal sanction, you know, the crown, the state has greenlit it. So they're just doing their duty. They're doing their job. It's, you know, right? It's like, the US Navy or US submarine patrolling the waters around Russia in the Cold War or something, right? From the Russian point of view, you're the enemy, you're the baddie, you're doing something wrong. But from the US point of view, you're doing exactly the right thing. You're doing your duty. So anyway, people like Drake and Hawkins, it's like that. Some people call them pirates, effectively. Others call them, you know, heroes. Anyway, if you're interested, on my channel, History Bro, I've got an 8 or 9 part series all about the life of Drake, quite a few hours, I don't know, like 4 or 5 plus hours, talking about the life and career of Sir Francis Drake. He's sort of the original. Drake is the original. He's so good. And like he does screw with the Spanish loads, like takes whole treasure ships, Spanish treasure ships, filled with silver and gold, and commerce of all different types coming from Panama, coming from the New World, sailing across the Atlantic back to Spain. And he takes them, like, he does it like three different times, like giant treasure, like treasure that's worth more than the whole year's GDP. Not that they had GDP exactly back then, but you know, you get the idea. Giant treasures that he stole, and just screwed with the Spanish on a pretty big scale for one man. Anyway, okay, so Drake is a little bit before Sir Walter Raleigh. Our story today is about Sir Walter Raleigh. I haven't forgotten. And there were other men. It weren't the only ones, but you know, Drake and Hawkins probably among the most famous. And Drake particularly becomes extremely famous for doing this, right? Sir Francis Drake is an example of it working, this policy of sending out a small number of ships, very small number, really, in the scheme of things, just to do privateering against the Spanish. It's sort of extraordinarily successful for what it is. And so lots of people, and he becomes famous, right? He's sort of a very, very poor nobody. And Elizabeth makes him a knight, and he gets a cut of the treasures that he steals. So he becomes extremely rich. You know, people look at Drake after he becomes a success. And he also circumnavigated the globe. He was the first Englishman to circumnavigate the globe. You know, in fact, you could argue that he's the first, well, it is true, that he's the first captain to circumnavigate the globe, right? He did, like Magellan himself personally, Elcano did, but Magellan didn't circumnavigate the globe, right? He dies in the Philippines, whereas Drake, you know, Elcano was the first to do it, but Drake goes all the way around the world and comes back and survives, as well as all the stuff he's done to screw the Spanish. He becomes extremely rich and powerful in his own lifetime. Now, other men, other adventurous men, see this, and of course, they want to do it, right? Every good Englishman in the Elizabethan age would love the opportunity to, you know, fight the Spanish. Again, it's sort of your duty to fight the Spanish and have an animosity with the Catholics, because the Catholics are butchering Protestants in Europe all the time. Well, both sides are butchering each other, but yeah, if you're an Elizabethan age adventurer, you want to fight the Catholics, fight the Spanish, you know, knock the Spanish off their perch of being the most powerful country in the world, basically, in the known world. And if anything, try and get a slice of that sweet, sweet colonial action in the New World. It's just one giant opportunity just waiting to be taken. You know, we know they knew that there were some indigenous native peoples in the New World, North and South America and the Caribbean, but right, they're no match for firearms and steel armor or iron armor and modern, that is 16th century, modern warfare and tactics and weaponry. So that's not too much of a problem, if you go over in force, that is. So it's just there to be taken, right? There is endless commodities, and there could even be sort of gold mines and lots of gold. We'll get onto the question of gold in a moment, or a bit later. But so it's sort of, it's almost like a no-brainer. Everyone wants an opportunity to exploit the New World and in the process screw over Spain and make England great again. Okay, enter the stage Sir Walter Raleigh. So he's a young man. He came from Devon, southwest, west country, not all that far from where I'm sitting right now. And along with a lot of these people, like Drake and Hawking, came from the west country and the south coast, sort of makes sense. And he was born into an aristocratic family, sort of an important aristocratic family, but they had some money, but they were far from fantastically rich. Right? They certainly weren't poor, but they weren't sort of swimming in money. But they were pretty well connected. They were very well connected. For example, Raleigh's mother, or some senior people, older people in his family, the generation older than him, were closely connected to Elizabeth herself. Or one of Raleigh's relatives had been her wet nurse, or one of her ladies in waiting, and sort of helped educate her and raise her. So his family were, you know, a bit more than middle class, not that there really was a middle class in the 16th century, but They were aristocratic, but minor aristocrats without a fantastic amount of money, but, you know, well connected.
We hope you enjoyed that video, and if you did, please head over to lotuseaters.com for the full unabridged video.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.